Well, happy Sabbath once again. We're in the midst of a series, and this is part two of the series of The Enduring Truth, the History of the New Testament Church. And so, to catch you up, or for those of you who hadn't heard the first part, we're studying the history and the context of the world into which the words of the New Testament were written. And we do this because it's helpful to understand the times then, and it really helps bring dimension to what we're learning now. And what we really hope through this series is that as we open the book and we're reading the words of the Bible, that we understand more and they start to come alive and they start to have a lot more depth. And understanding the history can really help. And we joked last time that sometimes studying history may make people break out in a cold sweat. That there's a PTSD element of history tests and that sort of thing. Yet, when we really understand how relevant everything that we're learning is, and how, as we will see as we go through the series, how much it affects life today, then this will all make sense. And maybe that's the shame about history, is that as you study it in school, you're given chunks, and they're kind of disparate, disjointed chunks of history that include lots of memorization of dates, and there's a little less, unless you have a great history teacher, which probably some of you did. There's a little less context and meaning about how it impacts us today. Well, we're going to hope that God is the great history teacher and he helps us to understand the context to today. And as disciples of Christ, it's better to understand this history and understand what he was saying and some of the background behind it. As we also think about the enduring truth, we think about becoming more dedicated to running our race with endurance. And Hebrews 12 and verse 1 reminds us that this is a necessary element of our Christian lives. It says, "Therefore we, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us." Sometimes it feels like we're carrying this heavy burden, but he's saying, just let's let that go and run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So as we think about that, we're thinking about Christ and his sacrifice at this time of year. We're thinking about what he did for us. We're thinking about the vision that he had and has, and the vision that we can align with that motivates everything that we do. If we turn to Jude, we can now very specifically start to consider what was asked of the New Testament church and what they were tasked with. He said, "Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints." So, at the time that Jude was written, he had to encourage them to contend for the truth, because even at that time, the truth was in a battlefield. They were in a battlefield for the truth because there were so many other ideas. But we do know that now and forever, the truth will endure. We also know that then, now, and forever, the truth will be challenged. As long as there's an adversary, the truth will be challenged. And as we talked about in a message several months ago, There's an attempt to eradicate truth altogether. Now that seems ridiculous. How could that be true? How could you eradicate truth? Well, if there is no basis for truth, if we do away with the basis for any absolute truth, then we can scatter the truth, but it won't matter. If we do away with the basis of truth, then what is true? Truth is really your perception. There's no such thing as truth. What's true for you may not be true for me, and may not be true for you. We all have our own different perceptions of truth. Do you see how this can start to really become a problem? And anyone who would argue for absolutes would be painted and therefore tainted by what? By whatever the accusation is. And let's consider that accusations are not from the playbook of our Creator. Let's consider that our Creator creates with His words. In John 1:1, we're introduced to Christ as the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and all that was created through Him, through the Word. And so He is creative and constructive. Who is destructive? Who is accusatory? Who tears down? So when you see that happening, when you see something being torn down, unless it's for the very right reasons and it's against the truth, but when something is not true, then you know the origin of that. And we'll have to be careful of that. So what happened? Let's look at John 8:32. I want you to know where in the Bible this is coming from. John 8:32. Jesus said to those Jews who believed Him, "If you abide in My word, you are My disciples indeed. If you abide in My word, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Now, we go a little farther here, and we get to Matthew 8:44, and he says to those who do not believe in Him and are not adhering to the truth, He says to them, "You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning." He destroys life, is what's being said here. And he does not stand for the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. But I tell you the truth, and you do not believe me. Do you see that? Do you see that in modern-day application? If we're paying attention, we'll see that in modern-day applications where what's true is called untrue or painted with whatever other adjective might be out there. So this is a battle that's occurring now and will continue to occur. So let's go back to very early on where God chooses Abraham and passes a blessing on from that point. God chose Abraham to be the father of a nation that would be God's chosen nation. Why did God choose Abraham? Does anybody know? I don't think we can know. Because it's a little bit of a trick question. Who knows why God chose Abraham? He just did. He's the creator and he can. It's Abraham that he said, "I want you to be the father of the nation." The Bible doesn't exactly say why, or maybe it does. There are attributes of Abraham that God appreciated. And God chose others very specifically, all the way up to us, by the way. We may always wonder why God chose us or our parents or our grandparents or whoever it was that introduced us. And we may never know the answer to that until we can ask Him ourselves. Why did you choose me to be blessed with this knowledge? That's what God does. And he's the creator, so he can choose who he wants. So he chose Abraham, which then went on to Isaac and Jacob, and then Jacob's name was changed to Israel. Jacob had his sons, and this continued on. They went into Egypt, and they came out of Egypt. God promised to be their king. He gave Moses the law and established the temple among them. So he called them out of Egypt. He took them out miraculously. That's what we're going to be thinking about on the night to be remembered as it's up and coming. And through these spring holy days, they march during that, and it's tradition. It's hard to know exactly if this is true or not. The Bible doesn't definitively say, but it's Jewish tradition that it was the last day of the days of unleavened bread, where their backs were up against the Egyptian army on one side and the Red Sea on the other, and that's when the miracle of the parting of the seas happened, and the Israelites marched through. Now, as is true with all things, I'll say scholars debate that. Scholars debate everything. That's what they do. So, there is some question about that, but there is tradition that would indicate that. So, they go out, and you would think that after all of these miracles and the plagues, that Israel would be so excited about becoming free from the slavery and being God's people, but even at this time, there were challenges to obeying God. And we're bringing up our PowerPoint. We had some lemonade some lemons this morning. It's good to, if you're flying a plane, have a parachute. I mean, maybe you might question the pilot if you feel like you need it, but let's just say you're the pilot. It's a good idea to have a parachute, and sometimes you may pack a backup parachute. Sometimes both may fail. So here's the backup to the backup to the backup parachute, and we'll catch up with our PowerPoint. So this is the enduring truth, the history of the New Testament. These are some of the sources of information for the sermon series, and for time I'll just skip through this, but we'll go over it again. And here we are with Abraham. And so they go into Egypt. They come out of Egypt. God promises to be their king. We see the parting of the seas. This truly was a grave that they went through, which helps us to understand the analogy of baptism, that as a nation they were baptized because they went through these waters that literally would have drowned them had they not been miraculously parted. And proof of that is that it did drown the Egyptian army. And actually today they have found a part of the sea where the divers go down and they're finding chassis from chariots and wagon wheels covered with barnacles and that sort of thing. So they found where the Red Sea crossing occurred. And it works well because much of that part of the ocean has very steep banks, but it just so happens that this is deep enough, but not too deep, where it would be very difficult for a nation of people to walk through, but it would be possible because of the depth and the landscape at the bottom of the ocean there. So it's not long, though, after this point that they start to long for something physical. Moses and Joshua are up on the mountain, and they're gone for a while. 40 days. They're up there fasting, and Moses is communing with God and getting the Ten Commandments and the law, and they start to get restless, and they start to think about what they had in Egypt, and they wanted something tactile that they could see, something physical. Well, this is not what God had intended for them, not what he wanted. Moses later wrote about this appeal that we as humans have for something physical, and he suggested that we look to the Creator, and that if we always look to the Creator as our source of truth, if we always look to the Creator as for the definition of right and wrong, then we will be blessed. Deuteronomy 28 contains blessings for obedience. What else does it contain? So Mr. Bosler pointed this out this week, and I had never noticed this. He said that he counted the verses for blessings for obedience and the verses for curses for disobedience. Any idea what the ratio is? Is it 1 to 1? No, it's more like 3 or 4 to 1 of curses for disobedience. In every case, there's the opposite of the blessing, and then there is more as well. So God gives us specific direction. And even in Deuteronomy, we're thinking about this time, even at the time of the Israelites, we know that they were bringing back memories of the religion and some of the practices that were true in Egypt. And there was more even going on than that. If we go to Deuteronomy 30 in verse 11, we get a little hint here, or a remez perhaps, of what might be going on at the time. So it says, "For this commandment," Deuteronomy 30:11, "which I command you today is not too mysterious for you, nor is it far off." So there were already some mysterious ideas about the soul and what might happen. And this gets then later incorporated into some of the other mystery type religions. But God's saying very clearly, or through Moses here, as Moses writes Deuteronomy, that it's not too mysterious for you, nor is it too far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, "Who will ascend into heaven for us and bring it to us?" Like you needed certain gods to go to heaven and back for you. So what he's clearly talking about are other religions here, not the throne of God. "Or who will ascend into heaven and bring it to us? Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, 'Who should go over the sea for us and bring it to us?'" Has anybody read the Odyssey of Homer or the Iliad? That's considered classic Greek literature that starts to document some of these ideas and starts to share how they had come together. When you first read it, it seems a little weird, and then when you start to compare it to some of the other religious ideas, you can start to see how they come together, and that's what's being addressed here. So, who should go over the sea? "But this word is very near to you. It's in your mouth and in your heart that you may do it." So God's laws are very understandable and concrete. In Joshua 8, Joshua, before entering into the promised land, or immediately after, I should say, they reread the law and committed to it. So as Joshua now had responsibility after Moses, he thought it was good to relay the foundation of God's law. So as we continue through history, we see that miraculously, clearly miraculously, because there were fortified cities in the land that was being given to the Israelites. And so therefore, there were cities already built, there were houses already built, there were roads already built, there were plants already planted, there were livestock, there was wealth in this land, and God gave it to the Israelites. And they were able to defeat it. Now here we see a depiction of Judah and Israel, and we'll start to come to understand that a little bit better. And we'll also have to acknowledge here that they never really drove out all of the inhabitants fully. Not until later, David expanded the kingdom, but they never really did it fully. And you can imagine it would be kind of exhausting having all of these battles. But more than that, it's also true that God said there were certain lands that weren't to be touched. And we can understand a little bit of history here. How many sons did Abraham have? 2? Would it surprise you to know that he had 9 sons? Keturah. Yeah, I hear Keturah. So actually, Moses had more sons than just Ishmael and Isaac. And later, Midian. So you see the Midianites, or you hear about the Midianites. You also see the Aramites up above. You see the Moabites and the Ammonites. Does anybody know who their ancestor was? Lot's nephew. So right after they left Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot had two daughters. They became impregnated and had these sons, Ammon and Moab. And so the Ammonites and the Moabites were descendants of that family, and God blessed them with land, and he said, don't take over that land. And what we also know that Ishmael, not only did Isaac have 12 sons, but so did Ishmael. And so there were 12 tribes that basically inhabit the Arabian Peninsula for the most part, and we refer to them today as Arabs. And they know that they're cousins. So we have the, here we know where the Midianites came from, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Ishmaelites, the Edomites. Here's another little fork in the road where there was Jacob and Esau. Jacob became Israel. Esau also had sons and also became a nation. And it says very clearly in Genesis 36:43 that Esau is the father of Edom. So that's where some of these surrounding lands and tribes come from. Well, they had a split and they started developing their own religions. They hadn't been, the truth hadn't been revealed to them in the same way that it had been with Israel. And so there was this constant desire to marry and intermarry with some of these surrounding nations. And then they would start to bring in some of these different religions, which was a problem. So Israel becomes a great nation. They have well-documented conquests. It was at its height in Solomon's time. And at this point, it was really the center of the civilized world here in the Middle East. So here's a depiction of Solomon and his court. And so it was during Solomon's realm that the first temple was built and dedicated. Solomon's temple was amazing. We can read about it. And at this time, gold became so common or everywhere that the most of the temple was overlaid with gold, that silver and copper was almost nothing at this point, considered near worthless. So we go through the realm of Saul, David, and Solomon. And these are powerful, charismatic kings at the time. And they're following, well, Saul didn't follow God for long. David did, and then Solomon did for a while. It kind of went through his phases. And Solomon undermined his role as a leader by intermarrying with others, most notably the daughter of Pharaoh. And this undermined his rule as a leader. We can turn over to 1 Kings 11:26 and know that God has a hand in all the events that occurred. 1 Kings 11, in verse 26, we're introduced to a character here that known as Solomon's servant, Jeroboam. And this man, verse 28, Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor, and Solomon recognizes something in this young man that he can use. Seeing that the young man was industrious, made him officer over the labor force of the house of Joseph. So he puts him in charge of many of his works and his projects. And so then later, God says to him in verse 33, because they, the people, have forsaken me, the tribes of Israel, and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, so we know who the Moabites were, and Milcom, the god of the people of Ammon, so we know who the Ammonites were. And we see that they had their gods, and Israel was starting to fall into worshiping them. And this was a problem. And they have not walked in my ways to do what is right in my eyes, and to keep my statutes and my judgments as Solomon's father David did. He's going to take the kingdom out of his hand. And there was a ceremonial thing where they had a cloth divided into 12, and Jeroboam took 10 of them. So he was taking 10 of the tribes, and the other two, which was really Judah, would stay with David and his line, which was Rehoboam. So we won't get too deep into that today. But what we're going to see is that Jeroboam, who actually became one of Israel's greatest villains. This kind of went to his head. And what occurs here is that Rehoboam, in chapter 12 of 1 Kings, becomes king after Solomon. And now Solomon was expanding the kingdom. He was building fantastic temples. And how was all this paid for? Taxes, right? So he taxed the people. Now, are taxes fun to pay? It's tax season. Does anybody like paying taxes? Oh, no. We don't like paying taxes. And they didn't either. But they had to pay taxes. And then when Rehoboam becomes king, then the question is whether or not he was going to be like his father, Solomon, or different. In verse 4 of chapter 12 of 1 Kings, it says, "Your father made our yoke heavy. This burden was heavy of building this kingdom. What will you do?" is the question. "If you lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, we will serve you." Well, then he goes to the elders that stood before his father and he asks some advice. And he gets some advice from them. He says, they say, lighten up a little bit. You can still do what you want to do, but lighten up. And then he goes to his buddies, those that grew up with him, and he says, "Hey, what do you guys think? Let's do this. Let's put the burden even heavier. Let's build more. Let's do more." And so he rejected the advice which the elders had given him, consulted those who he'd grown up with, and so he tells the people, he says, "This is going to be a whole lot heavier than my father. My little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. Now, whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scourges." This seems a little shocking for a person newly in the position to say, but that's what he said. And perhaps God inspired this because it says down in verse 15, "The king did not listen to the people, for the turn of events was for the Lord," or from the Lord, "that God might fulfill his word which the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam." So these things were coming together because God had caused it to be. Verse 19, now we see this split between the northern tribes of Israel, and we can go back here. We see the north here in the green became the land. It was the land of the 10 tribes of Israel. And then Judah down below was Jerusalem. And we see that in verse 21. "Rehoboam came to Jerusalem and he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin." So that's why it was considered two tribes. And yet most recognizable is Judah. So we'll talk about what happened to the tribes of Israel later, but this is why we consider Judah and the Jews as the most recognizable of all the tribes today, and they continued to have Jerusalem as they did then. Okay, so this was part of their practice that three times a year the Jews would go to Jerusalem to worship. So now Jeroboam, who has his capital in Samaria, you can see up to the north, should have a pointer. I don't know if you can see it, but it's up to in the middle of the green there, kind of to the left. This is Samaria. This is their capital. Now, Jeroboam is, remember, he's industrious. He's a wise, capable individual. And he becomes concerned about allowing his nation to go to Jerusalem. He thinks if they go to Jerusalem and worship, then they're going to develop an affinity for Rehoboam, perhaps. He could end up losing his kingdom. So what he does is he starts to institute some differences. And he starts to establish new places of worship. And so these new places of worship, 1 Kings 12, 25, we read that Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. And he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in the heart, "Now the kingdom may return to the house of David if these people go to sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. And then the heart of his people will turn back to their Lord and Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they'll kill me." So the king asked advice, and he made two calves of gold and said to the people, if it's too much to you, or it is too much to you, he says definitively, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem, here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. So here we see Jerusalem, we see the temple in Jerusalem, and what a prominent place it occupied there, a little bit of a close-up view. This was the jewel of Judah, and remains so to this day. And here we see Jeroboam implementing these new symbols, and you see the golden calf up there. And as I look at this, it looks a little confusing to me. Now, this is an artist's impression, of course, but it makes me kind of think of a new restaurant. Have you ever been to a new restaurant where they just open and all of the staff is brand new and they're kind of bumping into each other and they don't really know what they're doing and it's a little awkward and inefficient and you get the wrong food and it's late and it comes at different times and it kind of looks like this sort of chaotic scene here as they're trying to figure out what their religion is going to be is, and they blend it all up here. But this becomes an incredibly important aspect of the Jewish religion as it diverges here. So remember, 10 tribes are under the reign of Jeroboam. And it's at this point then that this split happens. Now, they still keep the Sabbath. What become the Samaritans or the tribes of Israel, they still keep the Sabbath. They still keep the holy days. So these Jewish laws, they're still keeping. They're just doing it differently here. So you can see in this, there's a calf up there, and the things just continually changed. Yet if you asked them, do you worship God? They'd say yes. Do you keep the Sabbath? Yes. Do you keep the holy days? Yes. Do they keep them as God defined it? The answer to that would be no. But they thought that they would be doing all of these things. Now, by the way, this blend was well known, and in Christ's time, let's fast forward to Christ's time, do we recognize that there's a rift between Judah and the Jews and the Samaritans? Oh yeah, don't even walk through that land. Walk around it. Those Samaritans, they have blended. They have blended religious practices. And it's true. They had. And so Christ walked through Samaria, though, and he extended to them what the next steps for them would be, but it was true that there was this split in religion. So now, right at this point, there are two different forms of Judaism. Now, more and more doctrines began to infiltrate Judaism, and in fact, we even saw in Deuteronomy that Moses was fighting with this in Joshua. So when we fast forward to today, and we see multiple different versions of Christianity, should we be surprised? This has been going on since the beginning, since the Genesis. So we learn from this. We also know that Simon Magus, and we'll get to Simon Magus later, he came from Samaria. And so he had these blended ideas, and he continued to carry on with that. Okay, so with the time that we have left, we're going to dive into some of these now major empires that occurred. We read in Deuteronomy, or we didn't read it, we talked about it though, that there would be curses for disobedience. And so we start to see these curses come true now. So first of all, the nations are divided. And then what happens, in 1250, the Assyrians come along, and the Assyrians take over the kingdom of Israel. So here you see the division with a little less noise around it. You see the different other kingdoms, but you see Israel and Judah. And then we're going to see the Assyrians come in and capture a big part of this. So the Assyrians take not quite all the way down to Judah, but they take over most of the territory of the Israelites. And this becomes the most powerful empire on earth in that part of the world. And they were brutal. They were brutal. The way that they worked with their captured nations was they said, pay taxes. So you have an option. You can stay in your land. You can be a good vassal state. You can pay your taxes, and all will be fine. Well, they didn't pay their taxes. So then they come with a little sterner message. This time, pay your taxes. Well, they didn't pay their taxes again, so the Assyrians come in and deport them. Take them out of their land, they lose their identity, they spread them and scatter them. And this was the scattering of the tribes of Israel. This is the start of it. Okay? So, by the way, it was sometime during this time that our good friend Jonah was encouraged to go to Nineveh to preach a message of repentance to who? Nineveh was square in Assyrian territory, so this was a capital city for the Assyrians. And he basically said, no way, I hate those guys. I mean, he doesn't mince words. I hate them. You want me to go there? No way. I'm going the other direction. I'm headed somewhere else. I'm going to San Diego. I'm going to take a boat and take off down to Mexico in today's world. I'm not going there. Won't do it. God says, oh, well, yeah, you will. So he had a plan for him. So this is the Mishki Gate. This was fairly recently, excavated and restored, and this could have been the Eastern Gate of Nineveh. So it could have been Jonah's fish-bleached body after being spit up on the shore that walked through this gate to preach that message of repentance to the city behind it. You want to know something else about this gate? Does anybody know what has recently happened to this gate? It's been destroyed or vandalized by ISIS as they seek to destroy and vandalize all remnants and relics that support the biblical narrative and are meaningful historically and religiously. And this is one of those victims, unfortunately. Okay, so we know that this resurgent Assyria and successive attacks over a 30-year period from 753 to 722, so this is 700 plus years before Christ, strips away Israel's territory with Samaria, the capital city, falling in 722. We read about Hosea and Amos, a couple of country boys that came to the cities and started to preach to them about repentance, but that did not work. And so from 721, for this 120-year period, these 10 tribes were deported, and identities were lost as distinct tribes. So we speculate who the Benjamites were, Naphtali, or are today, and Issachar. We speculate, and it's fun to speculate on that. I enjoy it, and maybe you do too. And thinking about who these nations might be today and who exhibits the characteristics that we read about in Genesis 49 and where those blessings went, but they lost their identity as distinct tribes. And then the Babylonians come in and take over and expand the empire. So we might remember one of the famous kings of Babylonia, Nebuchadnezzar. Thank you. And so when Nebuchadnezzar becomes king, Judah now is conquered. You can see that Israel is swallowed up here, and their empire goes all the way into Saudi Arabia and into much of Egypt. And there are multiple deportations. So in 605, they take many of the Jewish people away from Jerusalem. That's the first Jewish deportation. 597 was the second Jewish deportation. And in 587, Nebuchadnezzar destroys the temple. So now Jerusalem really starts to lose its identity as that temple is destroyed. Who was deported in these deportations? What's another famous biblical character deported during this time? Daniel. So Daniel was of royal blood. It says he was a noble. He was of royal blood. We can read back in Isaiah 39, verse 7 in 2 Kings, a couple of things about what could be true of Daniel. Now, this is a little chilling, and this is an uncomfortable thought, perhaps, maybe not what we wanted to think of Daniel, but it did say that Hezekiah's sons would serve as eunuchs in the court. And so, it's possible that Daniel was a eunuch, that he was made that way before being deported, and then he got there. We know that Daniel and his friends served the master of the eunuchs, which again doesn't definitively say he was a eunuch, but it did say, I think I was always on the bubble of that until reading that Hezekiah's sons would serve as eunuchs, and perhaps that gets the dots close enough to connect them. So again, an uncomfortable thought, and clearly we see that the nobles, that bloodline, had lost their power. And that very well proves it. And that was because of disobedience in other times. And so we see this happening now. This is the end of Israel as a nation. Jerusalem exists in this version of Judaism, but it really starts to look very different. And then we get to, of course, we have Daniel here, young men, saying they won't have any of those king's delicacies. It then goes into the Persian Empire, and Daniel did also serve into this realm. And who's a famous king of the Persian Empire? Ezra 1:1, we have Cyrus. And so Cyrus is interesting because he's named several hundred years before he's born by name in Isaiah 44 and 45. It's by name that Cyrus is mentioned, that he is going to accomplish God's will. Hundreds of years before he was even born, he is named by name to accomplish God's will to rebuild the temple. Only God can do that. So Cyrus, in Ezra 1:1, when he consolidates the Medes and the Persians into one empire, he acknowledges, and you can read it in Ezra 1:1, that God gave him this kingdom. And that it's one of his first acts, if not his first act as king, was to issue this decree to allow the Jews to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And here that's well documented. This is a stone that has been found, a cylindrical stone with these decrees clearly written. And if you have taken Western civilization, you can correlate this exactly to when Cyrus, a well-documented king in your standard Western civilization textbook, will show that Cyrus was the king of Persia and he did issue this decree, and that that Israel was a part of his empire. The Persians had mythology and deities that were central to their religious belief system. So the Greeks came after the Persians here, and they started to borrow from their astrological beliefs. And astrology began to play a big part in these religious systems. So I think what we'll do here, as we are about to head into the Greek Empire, is we'll put a pause on it for today, and we'll come back and pick it up at the Greek Empire. And it's the Greek Empire that really starts to take hold here, really starts to develop the philosophical beliefs that then roll into the Roman Empire. And I'll leave you with something, a little bit of a hook for next time. Said of the Greek and the Roman empires that a captive nation took a nation captive. Until next time.